Welcome to Olin, a straight-shooting, science-based podcast about periods, fertility, and nurturing health outside of unrealistic beauty expectations. We will mostly, but not exclusively, focus on hypothalamic amenorrhea, HA, a component of the female athlete triad, and relative energy deficiency in sport.
I'm Dr. Nicola Rinaldi, scientist and lead author of the book No Period, Now What? I specialize in helping people understand how their eating, exercise, and lifestyle habits are keeping them from hormonal health and their best life. My work focuses on regaining periods, improving fertility, and breaking free of the rules of underlying diet culture.
My name is Florence Gillet. I'm a certified eating psychology coach and the founder of BeyondBodyImage.com. I specialize in mental recovery, helping people let go of toxic health beliefs to finally feel at ease in their bodies at any size.
Every 2 weeks, the All In podcast brings you real recovery stories, expert insights, and new scientific research on HA, hormonal health, and fertility, with an unmissable touch of body respect and women's empowerment.
Just a reminder that this podcast represents the opinions of the hosts and their guests. The content here should not be taken as medical advice. It is for informational purposes only. And because each person is so unique, please consult your healthcare professional for any medical questions. Music by the Andy Shulman Band, available on Spotify. Hello, Nicola. It's nice to be here with you again.
Yes, absolutely. It's a lovely Sunday morning here in Boston, Massachusetts. And I'm really excited to introduce our guest today, who is Dr. Elise Goldberg. Dr. Goldberg obtained her medical degree from the University of Toronto and completed her residency training in internal medicine at Western University, where she serves as one of the chief medical residents. She returned to the University of Toronto to complete her training in endocrinology and then a clinical fellowship focusing on reproductive endocrinology at Women's College Hospital. During her training, she has received awards for outstanding contributions in medical education. She's published research articles on a variety of topics, including reproductive and gestational endocrinology. She has a special interest in polycystic ovarian syndrome and thyroid disease in patients with infertility, which is super cool because that's a lot, you know, a lot of that is wrapped around in what we do. So welcome to our podcast, Dr. Goldberg. Thank you so much for joining us. Could you tell us a little bit about how you became interested in endocrinology and reproductive endocrinology?
So thank you very much for having me. It's a lovely hot summer morning in Toronto today. So most people, when we discuss why, or the question becomes why do you go into endocrine, we give the same answer about pathways and chronic disease management, because a lot of endocrinology can focus on long-term relationships with your patients, those who mm-hmm. have diabetes, those who have thyroid disease, pituitary dysfunction, etc. What I loved about the reproductive focus, or particularly often it's reproductive age women that are the majority of my practice, is that you're actually capturing this group of people, these patients, at such a vulnerable time in their life where often you may be the only physician other than their primary care physician who referred to you, who is seeing them. It's one of their only engagements within the medical world. Mm-hmm. And you really set them up for a healthy pregnancy in the cases of some patients, if that's what they want to do, or even just later chronic diseases and lifetime medical care.
Mm-hmm. Great. And let's get straight into it. One thing that we've been wondering about recently is how much discussion there is in medical training about periods and amenorrhea, those sorts of topics. So we're interested to know if you learned about these topics in medical school or during any later parts of your training, like maybe residency or fellowship.
So my medical school, when I went through, which has now been changed over the past few years, there's been a lot of changes in medical education, mm-hmm. but we had 2 years focused of more like didactic teaching as well as small group learnings. Now there's a focus more on like case-based learning, because that's when people really seem to ingest the knowledge and be able to apply it. But I do recall probably in the earliest of my medical training when we were dating, like we've passed our 10-year reunion that didn't occur because of COVID from my medical class.
Oh.
One of the first cases I think I recall was about a pretty typical female athlete triad, which was then called female athlete triad. Now obviously has been renamed for the relative of energy deficit in sport. But a patient who was running and amenorrhea. And the goal was to then lead the medical students down the pathway of talking about all different reasons of amenorrhea and the diagnostic approach and the management of different aspects. But that was probably the first introduction and a very typical thin marathoning female patient who has lost their period and doesn't know why.
Yeah.
With the pearl of like rule out pregnancy.
I think that's one of the, you bring up one of the really important points is that thin marathon runner is sort of the typical what people think of as somebody who would have hypothalamic amenorrhea or HA. But I think in reality, there's a much broader spectrum of the population that experiences that. Do you often see patients with HA as a practicing endocrinologist? And how common is it in comparison to polycystic ovarian syndrome or PCOS in your experience?
So I do see a handful of HA. So I would say, but it's probably about a tenth of the referrals I get is for HA compared to PCOS. I don't know if that's because of that I get a lot of referrals for PCOS or the bias of patients who present to their physician and many patients who think that they're healthy otherwise and don't necessarily think that they need to see a doctor about their missing or wrong, elongated cycles. So there's so many biases. There's the referral bias, there's the presentation bias, and then there's the diagnostic bias. I trained with some fantastic clinicians, my mentor, one specifically, Dr. Sheila Lurito at Women's College, who was very astute in making sure that any diagnosis of PCOS was actually PCOS. And so I think that we may have captured patients who otherwise would have necessarily been thought of to not have HA. In my fellowship, we have like a longitudinal clinic from, again, it was many years ago, where we follow the same patients over the course of the 2 years of endocrine training. And I had like, we would joke at Women's that I had like many patients with hypothalamic amenorrhea. And it was just like, oh, another one? I'll send them to Elise. That's okay, because there's a whole cohort that we were working with. But then also, the other reason why I think PCOS might be so much more common, at least in Toronto, if it truly is the population we have. We have such a multinational melting pot of like lots of different ethnicities. And although I looked it up, I couldn't find any specific epidemiological data about different ethnicities. From my personal experience, a lot of South Asian patients predominantly will end up with period irregularities related to PCOS versus the Caucasians will end up with it related, not always, but more likely for HA than other nationalities and ethnicities.
That's fascinating. I wish somebody would do a study to look at sort of the prevalence of the different conditions, the different types of amenorrhea across ethnicities, because I think that could be really informative.
And then also, like, they have statistics about, like, the prevalence of, like, which cause of amenorrhea is more frequent. And HA is actually the most common, which is interesting to me because that's not what you see in clinical practice. But the estimate on, like, the articles I found was, like, 35% of all secondary amenorrhea is HA, 30% is ovarian, which can include, like, POI or PCOS, and then the remaining is like other.
And POI is
premature ovarian insufficiency.
Okay, That seems to be a condition that has a lot of different names, right?
Well, it used to be called premature ovarian failure.
Okay.
But people don't fail.
Right.
And their ovaries aren't failing, but they're insufficient to the estrogen demands of that time of their life. So I believe
interesting.
That that's the woke.
It designates the same thing, right? Mm-hmm. It's just the more recent way that you want to use it. And I love that idea that they're not failing at all.
Yes.
Another question that we had for you were, when you have those HA patients coming to you, do you find yourself actually recommending something similar to what No Period Now What typically recommends in terms of engaging in recovery?
In terms of modifying the energy balance? Yes.
Yes.
Yes, because that's the underlying cause. And in fact, I would argue that sometimes the medical doctor in this case is not as important as the other supports, whether it be the mental health support, the nutritional encouragement support, that needs to be targeted first. From a medical perspective, I mean, doctors are trained to prescribe medication, and it's actually been in hot debate since, I guess, the 2017 guidelines came out from the Endocrine Society about the use of hormone replacement therapy in this population. And it's quite debated still, because the evidence is not very good that slapping on an estrogen patch is going to regain the bone mass and fix the cortisol and growth hormone and other stressors that are put on the body during the energy deficit state, energy deficient state.
Yep.
So do you typically, sorry, that's a side question. Do you typically then recommend for these women to get extra support outside of your follow-up?
Yes. So I think that as a specialist, I often refer back to the family doctor and send back a note with collaborative ideas. Mm-hmm. And the mental health support would be probably the key aspect. In Canada, we're so fortunate. We have our single payer medical system that the government pays for our medical care. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, mental health support is not the same. And that can be a big barrier to many patients,
right?
Because financially, it's not covered unless people are fortunate enough to have some private pay options. And even still, it's quite expensive and can be a barrier.
Right.
Yeah. How often do you see a patient who's coming to you with some kind of amenorrhea and you find that they've been misdiagnosed or told that they're, you know, told that they have something, some other underlying cause for their amenorrhea or?
Well, I think PCOS is just commonly seen. And even by endocrinologists, I often have a diabetes hat on. So we're looking for insulin resistance. We're looking for a common condition that we think is the majority of people. And particular if patients have an elevated BMI, it's and don't fit in their box of thin female exerciser or just very thin, really, then it just HA may just not be on the top of their, like on their forefront. The other thing, they're both diagnoses of exclusion. And so you have a normal BMI patient who doesn't necessarily disclose their anxiety, exercise, eating habits, because it's not always asked. It doesn't always, like often it is in these types of discussions, but it may not be. And then they have a little bit of acne and their ovaries are kind of borderline, because that's not a useful test for these patients. So they fit criteria for PCOS, but they also fit criteria for HA. Like it's not always clear cut. I know that a lot of people talk about this big misdiagnosis, and we all see it, but I also am surrounded by such fantastically trained individuals and there's a close-knit endocrine group who are all very, you know, like in close contact with each other, whether it be on Facebook or WhatsApp or whatever. And it seems to be on the forefront of all of our minds. So I find it so difficult to think that it's not on others. And I find like the family doctors that refer to me are also like pretty brilliant mm-hmm. people, and it's on their mind too. And sometimes they get referred just for a reassurance or confirmation of what their family doctor was already telling them. So
I kind of want to move to Toronto.
I know. Where do we sign? Elise, get us there.
No, I think that the Canadian medical training is pretty good. Although, like, there's biases everywhere, and the female male bias. Like, it's hard for me, obviously, to imagine exactly what's going on in other people's minds. But we had a recent rounds at the hospital that I am affiliated with. On HA. And it was interesting to hear. So three of us young female physicians there have a more reproductive gestational focus. We work in the gestational diabetes clinic together. And we see a lot of young reproductive age menstruating patients. And some of the male colleagues that were there were focusing just like, oh, these women, we see them later on in life and they just have really bad bones. We really need to get them on hormones. And I don't want to be like ageist, but it was just like, oh, well, actually we all discussed it because we have a wonderful collegial group. Mm-hmm. And it was just like a different perspective. And obviously everyone's goal is to help their patients and to prevent them from having long-term medical complications. But they don't always realize like what the underlying, I guess, risk of if you're just focusing on bone production and in a patient who has a lot of other comorbidities that are going to need to be addressed and are often not on the forefront of discussion or on the forefront of the patient's presentation.
Yeah, that's such an important point, how we really need to take care of the whole person and not just the bones, because there's so much more that the HA affects than just bone density. And I mean, that probably is the biggest negative long-term consequence, but the short-term consequences are also fairly significant. And, people really benefit from working on recovery in terms of their mental health and, you know, short-term physical things like libido and vaginal lubrication and hair and nails and all those sorts of things, feeling cold all the time.
And I think sometimes, you know, we're a bit hard on doctors as well, because we say like, oh, you know, this is misdiagnosis, and, you know, they diagnose you with PCOS when you in fact had HA, and then you were put like this wrong path. But I'm not sure how much doctors are also trained to actually have that discussion with their patients. And for patients also to feel like, okay, I can disclose what I'm really doing around food and exercise, for example, because disordered eating also happens in a bit of a secrecy, right? It's a bit of shame attached to it, that the only way for me to maintain this weight is that I have to do all these things, maybe things that are, you know, seen as really disordered, like purging, for example. And the first time you go see your endocrinologist, it's not easy to go and disclose all that stuff like upfront, right? You have to be in a level of self-awareness also for you to be able to disclose that, and for the doctor to also ask the right questions without hurting, you know, mentally that patient. Do you find that, how did you kind of develop your own way of navigating what the patient says, how to know what they're doing?
Well, I imagine it changes, and it has changed over the past many years, and now over computer, it's a whole nother experience trying to really engage with people and get them to trust you when you're just seeing them over Zoom or whatever modality you're using. So I think there's like two important concepts that I can think of with regard to that. One is that people don't always get a diagnosis when they first see someone, and not everything is a slam dunk.
Yep.
And people presentations change and evolve and develop. So sometimes you see someone, the blood work all looks fine, and you're just like, well, I don't really know what's going on. Let's just track you over time and see. Because sometimes things come out, whether it's because of the relationship you have with the patient and what happens to them in their life. And sometimes they get better because of probably external factors as well. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they don't, and other things develop and kind of push you in different and sway you in different directions. The other thing is that it's not always that clear cut. The other thing is that some patients will actually tell you, if you ask them what they think is going on, they'll just say, I think I'm exercising a little too much. But probably, if you think that, then you typically know yourself the best.
Yes.
And so I've had that conversation with certain patients. And I mean, obviously others are much more in denial or don't want to make those changes or aren't willing to accept that their lifestyle is potentially not ideal.
Yeah.
But often asking people seems to be a useful tool if you at all suspect it.
Yeah.
PCOS, it's a little bit of a different ball game, but because it's also a spectrum of conditions and very highly debated whether it's insulin resistance, which then comes along with some dietary, at least mentions, which again have been changed over my career so far, or whether or not it's just a hyperandrogenism syndrome, which is also thought to be the underlying cause and less related to dietary changes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's so many different aspects that you have to, or not have to, you want to mention lifestyle factors, but you don't want to over mention lifestyle factors because you don't want to set people off on, I guess, paths to then lead to harm in the future. So it's a challenging balance as well.
Yeah.
You've mentioned insulin resistance a couple of times. Is there sort of a gold standard test for that, or is there? How do you figure that one out?
So I mean, there's clues. There's debates over certain lab tests. But overt insulin resistance, like when you actually get into a pre-diabetes range or a diabetes range, can lead to other consequences. And I do think that needs to be mentioned and treated and optimized so that patients have the healthiest chance of avoiding complications from that perspective.
Mm-hmm. We discussed before about premature ovarian insufficiency. Mm-hmm. And so that could be another possible reason for amenorrhea, right? Mm-hmm. So can you tell us a bit more about this? How common is it compared to HA, do you think?
Oh, it's way less common. Mm-hmm. And often what people are afraid of when they present with actual amenorrhea, because they are afraid they're in early menopause.
And
hopefully that there are often different symptoms, but they can overlap, and they're often different situations. But again, everything can overlap because disordered eating are so common. Mm-hmm. The diagnostic criteria for POI requires two separate FSHs that are separated by at least 2 weeks.
Okay.
So that would be how you diagnose it. But when people are also like similar to coming off the pill, like when they're in recovery, I think there's lots of fluctuations in hormones as your pituitary starts to just kind of unsuppress, which is why you need the two separate readings in order to establish that diagnosis.
Right.
Okay.
Great.
Because I've seen a couple of people who've had quite high FSH levels. That might be suggestive of POI, but FSH has decreased and cycling resumed with HA recovery. As you're saying, that is extremely unusual. I think I can think of three people that's happened to, and then a few more than that who have had primary ovarian insufficiency. Do you have any idea what could be going on, like why the FSH could be going so high sometimes? It just seems like a strange I mean, because FSH is usually thought of mostly mm-hmm. as a marker of sort of ovarian health. I don't know exactly what term you might choose to use there.
I just call it the hormone that's yelling at your ovaries uh-huh. from your brain, like saying, wake up. So I don't know if that simplistic term just means that it's yelling at it to wake up. And if it's not sustained because the ovaries wake up,
yeah,
then maybe it goes back down. So I have seen in two patients where coming off the pill, they had very high FSHs, but then never mm-hmm. again. Mm-hmm. And then we kind of brushed it off.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, I think one thing that I've learned through working with people over the years is just what an incredible range of different presentations there mm-hmm. are of all these things. I mean, we keep talking about how, yeah, everybody is unique, and it's kind of amazing that we can all be so, you know, overtly similar. I mean, we're all human beings, but yet mm-hmm. have so many unique situations. I think it's fascinating.
I also think that it isn't well documented. Like, no one's taken patients off a pill or recovered them from suppression of their hypothalamus for whatever reason and measured hormone levels sequentially mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. or the pulses, because it is a pulsatile nature that we're experiencing. So if you're capturing it in that moment, then perhaps that can explain it.
Yeah.
Anybody listening who wants to do that type of research?
Wouldn't be easy research to do.
No, it wouldn't.
So another issue seen not infrequently in those with HA is elevated liver enzymes. Is this something you've come across? And why do you think that might be going on?
So I suspect that probably is related to some of the gastrointestinal complications of eating disorders, like similarly, but you're just seeing a spectrum. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure there's some sort of toxicity or oxidative status of the on the liver when it's in starvation mode, essentially. That would be my guess.
Yeah.
But I imagine it's not that infrequent. Liver enzymes seem to be quite sensitive mm-hmm. and go up mm-hmm. for so many different reasons. But again, I would imagine if it's sustained, then you need to look into it further, and whether that's with imaging or just further ruling out other causes to make sure that they're not missing anything. And then if you're not missing anything, continue with the same recovery recommendations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it would be similar to kind of test maybe a little bit later down the line and see what happens and if the liver enzymes remain mm-hmm. unusually high.
Yeah, it's well described in anorexia uh-huh. To have elevated liver enzymes.
Okay.
So probably just how people on different parts of that spectrum leading to full out complicated eating disorders with significant underfueling respond is probably just genetically based mm-hmm. who gets what complication when.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So another question that comes up sometimes is whether there's a link between having had HA or an eating disorder and thyroid conditions like Hashimoto's disease, for example. So we know that low T3 is associated with underfueling. I think I've seen that in a couple of different research studies. But what about the autoimmune component? Is there any relationship there? I mean,
so the low T3 is due to a condition called sick euthyroid syndrome. Mm-hmm. So with any stressor, we see it in patients in the ICU who have other chronic diseases, that the similar to your body trying to promote your organs and not focus on the reproductive organs, thyroid metabolism can increase your metabolic rate. So if you have lower T3, you're going to slow down your metabolic rate, similar to slowing down everything else and preserving mm-hmm. your energy. In terms of autoimmune, so I've looked a little bit into this, and I was not able to find any validated articles. That being said, it's probably more that no one's looked at it. I don't see in my mind the potential link, because HA is not an autoimmune condition.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And autoimmune conditions, although they seem to kind of go together, like many autoimmune conditions run together. They're not necessarily associated with external factors to the same amount. That being said, I have had a number of patients who have had thyroiditis. So that's when the thyroid just releases all of its hormone due to external stress. You get hyperthyroidism and then often hypothyroidism, and most of the time resolution of the thyroid function to some extent, although still may require medication. Those seem to happen after, well, either illnesses, viral infections, mm-hmm. But can also be due to life stressors. I've had patients post a death in the family. So it's hard to know whether or not this chronic stress can bring on a flare of an autoimmune condition from that perspective, but there's no data to suggest it, and it might be a bit stretching.
Right. Yeah. My response to people is usually it's unlikely to be related, but it's helpful to hear the same thing from you that mm-hmm. it's unlikely to be.
The other thing is TPO antibodies, which is the marker of an autoimmune versus non-autoimmune thyroid dysfunction, although that's most, even TPO negative patients with thyroid dysfunction, we still think that probably is autoimmune component. Mm-hmm. But that those autoantibodies are so frequent in young reproductive age females, about 10 to 15%, depending on, or at least 10 to 15% of patients with infertility of any cause will have TPO antibodies. It's probably pretty similar in the population. So they're just really common. And they don't necessarily mean that you have thyroid dysfunction now either. It just means that you have a future risk of thyroid dysfunction, which could be when you're 90. Mm-hmm. So not everyone who has antibodies that are positive requires medication.
Right.
So if you have TPO antibodies, but your thyroid function seems to be normal, is there anything you can do about that, or is it just a wait and see?
It's a wait and see.
Yeah. Okay.
There is no evidence-based therapy. Mm-hmm. Definitely no evidence-based lifestyle therapy. I mean, there are studies about how, let's say, the gut immunity is going to affect the systemic immunity. Mm-hmm. But at this point, there is no confirming evidence. I mean, that's not to say that there won't be in the future, but right now there's no evidence that there's lifestyle factors that can affect having a TPO antibody or the future risk of thyroid dysfunction. Hopefully one day that'll change and we can give people good evidence-based advice.
Yep.
But right now there isn't.
Fingers crossed for the future. So that's a more of a generic question, but what do you think of all the hormone balancing diets out there?
So I don't know much about hormone balancing diets. So I tried to Google it. I didn't come up with much, to be honest. I'm always hesitant to take advice from people, A, who are getting money from you. Mm-hmm. And that's part of being a physician in Canada, where no one presents a credit card when they come to the office. Like, it's all paid for. So it's hard to ever. And so you suspect everyone has alternative motives. But things like lifestyle advice and dietary advice are often not based on much, or based on hearsay of someone and articles that are not based on true data. If there was a diet that could fix people's hormones, I would love to be able to prescribe it.
I think part of the issue is that, as we were discussing before, there isn't one hormonal problem that people have. So, I mean, I think a lot of times, you know, supplements or whatever, it's like hormone balancing supplements, like, well, what hormones exactly is this supposed to balance? Because, you know, PCOS is very different from HA, for example. So you can't possibly say that there's this magical supplement that's going to work for everything. And
So I don't know. I don't know if that has to do with the obsession with gluten and dairy and who knows what else, depending on the year. But at this point, if food makes you feel sick, don't eat it. If it makes you feel good, eat it. I'm much less prescriptive. But with HA, it's really just eat food and more of it.
Yes.
So there, I don't think there's any special foods that, that I mean, you would know better because I think that with writing the book, you came across like certain like adjuncts, like flax and other things. But in general,
it's still not magic. Still not magic.
Still just eat food.
Yes.
Yeah, the main thing is the energy deficit that you mm-hmm. need to solve, right? So whether you do that with one food or another, and I think, you know, one of the things that we talk about a lot on the podcast, and I know you've listened to other episodes, is that we really don't believe there are superfoods or unclean foods. Or, you know, we're just saying all foods are foods and there's no moral attachment to
how clean eating is one of my favorites. Like, unless you live with like my son and then you're like, I know what non-clean eating is like, because he'll eat stuff from anywhere mm-hmm. off of floors mm-hmm. and grounds and like actual like physical dirt. But I'm not very active on social media and
good so for you.
Is it? I don't know. So it is because like from my own personal mental health perspective, sure.
Totally.
But sometimes I forget that I need to go back on and like engage in what my patients are reading and making sure that I'm familiar with hormone balancing diets because people come in and they tell me that they are doing all sorts of things mm-hmm. that I then need to look up afterwards. Mm-hmm. Being like, oh, interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I have a question. Do you find that patients who, are restricting without exercise have a different prognosis in terms of time to resolution recovery? I mean, I know that's very variable versus the athletes who are focused on the athletic performance and then as a byproduct of that athletic performance, less of a body issue, more of like athletic focus, uh-huh. They end up with HA.
That's an interesting question. There's, I think almost everybody that I see has some level of exercise associated with their HA. So, there are not many people who are only eating restrictively. But I think that the time to recover, it definitely depends on sort of how quickly the patients are able to restore their energy balance. Because I don't know if you know, when I first wrote the book, the survey that I did, I found that the median time to recovery was about 5 months. And with some people taking, you know, 2 or 3 years. And part of that was, I think, not having really good guidelines as to what to do to recover. So some people were, quote unquote, working on recovery, but it was really just, you know, eating a tiny bit more or maybe cutting out one day a week of exercise. Whereas now I think that the book is out there and there are stronger guidelines for what people really need to do. I did a non-scientific survey in my Facebook group because it seemed like there were a lot more people recovering much more quickly than would be the case if 5 months were truly the median. So the median now, I would say, you know, from that totally non-scientific survey was closer to 3 months. Mm-hmm. But I haven't really looked into whether there's a difference between people who are simply underfueling versus underfueling plus exercise. And my recommendation is always, you know, cut out the high intensity exercise or mitigate mm-hmm. it, moderate it as much as possible. So in a way, you're kind of getting both groups of people to the same place fairly quickly. I think somebody who's an athlete for, you know, for a job is, you know, that's actually a much harder case because then it's, mm-hmm. they really can't give up that exercise or they can't tone it down for a bit. So that's often a bit longer for recovery, but
yeah, I've seen, I think the most challenging cases I've seen were either like a ballerina, like a professional ballerina, uh-huh. Or actually it's the young patients. They're not as motivated to get their cycles back because they're young and their pregnancy isn't on their mind.
Yep.
Not that it's on everyone else's mind either. But the young patients, it's just like telling them that they may have osteoporosis in 10 years or 30 years is not an inciting factor when, like, I just want to be an athlete. And it's sometimes not even about body image. It's really about athleticism for them. And it's like a byproduct. So I find those are the hardest sells.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's a question of identity as well, right? So once you attach a certain way of life or routine or behaviors to who you are as a person, and we come in with our big shoes, like saying, it's okay, just have to eat three times what you're eating and do a lot less exercise, it's going to be a big 180 for them to do before they're able to really apply that. But what I find personally, and you know, I mostly work with women on body image. I don't have the science background that you ladies have. But what I find is, like, it's always going to be harder if I have women coming to me that work in the healthcare position, for example, because let's face it, healthcare is typically quite fat phobic. Or so, you know, if I work with a dietitian, for example, it's going to be really hard because there's a good chance that most of her living and presence online and whatever else she does is going to be related to, you know, dieting or controlling what you eat or how you exercise. And in the same way for athletes, obviously it's going to be related to their livelihood. If I work with somebody who works at a bank, for example, it's going to be a lot easier for them to just turn around and change their ways. I don't know. I find that that's maybe my, it's obviously, again, not evidence-based. It's just my own experience with clients. And yeah, anybody who works in a job that really, that where their appearance actually matters, or where their weight matters, or where their performance, athletic performance matters, it's going to be hard to make those changes, because this is who they are, right?
Yeah, I think one thing that can be helpful is getting the athletic coaches on board, and encouraging them to encourage their players to make sure they're fueling properly, because I think particularly as young athletes develop, they start spending more and more and more time doing their sport, which obviously is more of an energy drain. But I think there's very little education about, okay, now you're doing gymnastics 5 days a week for 4 hours a time, you need to eat more than you were last year when you were only doing it 3 days a week for 2 hours. And I think that, you know, I think that getting coaches involved as well as athletes are kind of growing up through that system and encouraging them to fuel their bodies properly, I think can be really helpful. Because that way, if you prevent the amenorrhea in the first place, then it's, you know, obviously you're in a very different situation than trying to recover a period from a body that's already shut down.
And I think it's the same, I mean, you're going along the same lines as this young runner, Mary Kane, who had, she came out publicly about being really badly treated as
a Nike runner,
and going to the Oregon Project, I think it was called, where they were supposed to be like, you know, la crème de la crème of running and runners. And obviously Nike comes and knocks at your door and you're teenage girl trying to make it as an athlete, you're going to be thrilled. But the reality is all these coaches were male and had no idea that losing your cycle is actually being counterproductive over time, right? So I think that's one of the things also that I wish, as Nicolai is saying, we need more coaches also being aware that losing your period might improve your performance, but very, very short term. And then you're going to face injuries and problems and bad form and tiredness, exhaustion, stress fractures, mental issues. So, yeah, I think definitely that's, And how do you reach out to all these people? That's the next question.
Yeah. So, Elise, anything else that you would like to share with our audience today? Anything else that's on your mind? Or
I guess going back to that, a lot of people have been frustrated or get frustrated with their physicians. And I guess like trying to defend doctors, but trying to say that when they get referred, and often the physician really just wants to help, and they don't mean to. If a patient gets misdiagnosed, like it's obviously it's not intentional. Mm-hmm. The goal is to improve this patient's life and risks of future complications from whatever condition they have. But don't be afraid to advocate for yourself if you think that something else is being missed or overlooked. We're all just want to work together, because having a collaborative approach with your patients is obviously much more successful than just telling them what you think that they should be doing. Mm-hmm.
I think you said that earlier in the recording as well, that you said like at the end of the day, it's your body, right? So I'm your physician, but you know also much more than I do because you live in that body. Mm-hmm. So I love that you said that. I think for a lot of practitioners, maybe it's just in Toronto that they're like that.
I don't know. I mean, no, it's not, because I did my internal medicine in London, Ontario, and they were equally lovely.
Okay.
So I think, and I've met other ones in throughout Canada. I mean, I've met people in the States as well who are lovely.
Yeah.
So
I was just joking, but yeah, I think a lot of it's not that common to hear practitioners say at the end of the day, your body, your rules as well. Like, you know how to share a lot of the stuff, and we have to collaborate to get you better. I love that you said that. So we like to ask each of our guests how they are all in their lives. So, which is just more than food and exercise, but really being present and giving it all and not holding back, you know, advocating for our needs and all that type of stuff. So how are you all in, Dr. Goldberg?
So I've been working from home, plus having the children be schooling from home, which is as all in as you can get. Mm-hmm. And I guess 3 weeks ago, we decided to add to our chaos. I think our family was just languishing. We needed an upbeat change. And now we have a puppy.
Oh my gosh.
who is right here.
The pandemic puppy.
We got a pandemic puppy. This is Charlie, like the chocolate factory.
Oh, nice.
Because we've read lots and lots and lots of books. And I think at the beginning, one of the first book series we read were the Ronald Dahl. Or
Ronald. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Amazing. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thank you so much for your time and your knowledge and everything that you do. Yeah, I think this has been an amazing conversation, and I think our listeners will really appreciate hearing a lot of what you had to say. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
It was a nice break from the morning.
Bye.
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 Hey there. So this is Nico and Florence, and we just wanted to say thank you to Dr. Goldberg and all of our other guests who have been on with us this season. We are planning on taking a break over the summer for us, winter for those of you in the Southern Hemisphere, just because we both have children and they're not necessarily in activities all the time. So it just logistically gets a little bit harder. We hope you've enjoyed this season. We've really appreciated the comments and feedback that we've gotten from all our listeners. And we'll start up again in September or October of next year. And we've got some great ideas for people to have on the podcast for next season. So would you like to tell us a little bit about that, Florence?
Yes. So obviously, I mean, we both had a lot of fun recording this podcast, and I think it's funny, it took us so long to get it started, and then now it feels quite natural, right?
Yes.
I also need to say a big thank you to Stephen, who is
yes,
editing.
Yes, so much.
Without him, I think it would take us a lot more effort to get those shows ready. And he's amazing and he's really super kind and super available. So thank you, Stephen. Yes. So next season, we have in mind to talk more about, we want to go a little bit more into maybe exercise. I think both Nicola and I, we find that sometimes it's really holding people back in their recovery, this kind of exercise addiction or compulsion. So we want to maybe try and speak, and we don't want to disclose names because obviously we want to make sure that, you know, we're going to get the people on board before we announce anything. We like to keep a little bit of a suspense type thing, but, you know, maybe athletes and obviously more people also from the health every size movement, talking a little bit more about maybe weight stigma or intersectionality, those topics that you've heard us already talk about. We want to get more researchers, right? Researchers on different topics. I think some of those topics were maybe bone density or stress resistance. Like, we had in mind to just kind of go a little bit deeper on those topics. And you're also obviously more than welcome to propose some topics if you feel like they are missing from the All In podcast. You can reach out to us quite easily. In the show notes, you will find the email address that you can reach out to us through. And we hope everybody has a wonderful summer or winter. And we'll be back very soon. And obviously during summer, we will remind you of the 15 episodes that we brought out in the season one. We've had pretty cool guests, right? I think it would be really difficult to pick what would be your favorite episode. But we will remind you of those, and hopefully you can listen to those. If you haven't listened to the whole season one, you can spend some more time during your holiday, if you get a holiday at that time, to just listen to some more, and follow our guests as well. And they usually also have resources that are really good. So yeah. We're really looking forward to a little bit of a break, but I think very much looking forward to be back as well.
Yes, definitely.
Awesome.
All right. Thanks so much, everybody.
Yes. Thank you for being there with us, and take good care of yourselves. Yep. Bye.
Bye. All right. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Maybe take a few minutes to reflect on it and how you have been all in this past week. It always strikes me how different each person's all-in journey is. As I often say, there are many paths to HA and many paths out of it. Your journey is unique.
That is so true. And if you need more support on your journey, you should definitely start with No Period Now What, which you can get at noperiod.info/book.
And Florence and I both work with people on different aspects of period recovery and so much more. So if you'd like more personal advice and attention, you can go to noperiod.info/appointments to schedule a time to speak with me on fixing the issues underlying your missing periods and figuring out what those issues are.
And I'm at beyondbodyimage.com to work with me on the deeper emotional issues and your body image. I also run a French Instagram account, aminore_fr. And obviously you can find Nicola at No Period Now What on Instagram. We also have joined clients, so you can access both our domains of expertise at the same time. If you enjoyed this podcast and found it helpful, please drop us a review to help more people find it.
Also, join the No Period Now What recovery support group at noperiod.info/support and let us know how All In is going for you.
All In is not just about period recovery, it's about getting your life back. See you in 2 weeks.
You were lost in Babylon, till you got lost again. You were lost in Babylon, now find yourself and then. Take all that you've learned about what love and loss, pleasure and pain, and never get lost again.